Hello and welcome to another episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie, brought to you by Killer Podcasts, an evergreen podcasts network. I'm the titular Sean.
And I'm the very titular Carrie.
It's the show that takes you inside the unbelievable, the unexplainable, the macabre, and the bizarre, and tries to find an answer. And it is the end of Axe Murder March, Caroline. Yep, it was a more figurative axe murder march for the last couple of weeks.
Listen, I did my best. I did 4 weeks on Lizzie Borden last year. I did my best trying to find an axe, quote-unquote, murder this time.
I think you did great. And Euronymous was not killed with an axe, but he did shred with an axe. And we heard some of that shredding over the last couple of weeks. Some beautiful needle drops from Mayhem. Carrie loves it.
Eesh.
But this week, we're getting a little more literal to close out Axe Murder March. I think it's been a little while since our patrons got any audio goodies, and I think we're going to have an audio extra in the Patreon feed this week, because I've got an extra axe story that I found that I considered for this episode. That I think I'll just tell, you know, I'll save just for the boys, B-O-I-Z, on Patreon. Some of them are women. It's not a gendered term.
Sure.
For me.
A cis male.
Yeah. So check in there for the Korean axe murder incident later this week.
Axe murder incident is a weird pullback at the end there. Axe murder incident?
We're not sure what happened. We are sure what happened. It
sounds like an axe murder.
Yeah, and many axes are involved. It's a pretty interesting story, and we'll talk about it on Patreon. But this week on this show, we are talking about Leonardo Cianciulli, the soap maker of Correggio.
You're bringing the Italians back into it, aren't you?
Well, very astute, Carrie. Leonardo was...
Oh, yeah. Yeah, to take my real Italian knowledge to figure out that guy was Italian.
You're a quick one. Oh, no, Leonarda. She's a woman.
Ah.
The doctor was a woman.
The murderer was a woman.
And there's not many of those, Carrie. Not a lot of female serial killers, not famous ones.
Yeah, you guys really cornered the market on that.
Yeah, well, you know, if you're good at it, you do it or something. Don't do it. Nobody do it.
Commit murder? Yes.
Yeah.
That's a stance I feel good about taking on this show.
We have a woman serial killer this week, an Italian witchy woman.
Okay, don't look at me like that.
And she was convicted of 3 murders all the way back in 1946. But we're going to tell you the whole story now, Carrie. Leonardo Cianciulli was born April 14th, 1893. Oh, an Aries. Interesting.
Yeah, you better not mess with us. Even though I literally relate to nothing about the Aries sign. You're very much a Taurus, but I am very much not an Aries.
Well, I don't know what is associated with Aries.
Taurus, they love hanging out. They're very laid back. They love to party. They're just good time boys.
Okay.
Aries are all, they're very fiery and competitive, and, you know, they have temper tantrums, and they have so much energy that they have to use. It's like, no, bitch, I'm tired, and I don't care about competition.
Yeah, I've seen a temper tantrum or two, but that's usually
not a tantrum.
Overtired.
Yes, exactly.
So she was an Aries.
thanks, Sean.
Cianciulli was born in the small town of Montello Avellino in what was then the Kingdom of Italy. And her mother, Amelia Dinolfi, by birth, it's a grim story right up top. I guess keep in mind, I think these biographical details are mostly, we have them from Leonarda herself, and... You know, I mean, a lot of serial killers write about themselves after they get arrested.
Yeah, they zhuzh up the story.
Yeah, so who knows how much of it you can trust. But anyway, according to Leonarda, her childhood was very dark, and it started in a dark place. Because Amelia was allegedly sexually assaulted at age 15 by Mariano Cianciulli, who was, I guess, an unemployed drunk, is how he's described by his daughter, in his mid-40s at the time. Mm. And when it turned out that Amelia was pregnant from the encounter, both sets of parents forced the two to get married, and that was kind of the only punishment for this guy for raping this girl.
Yeah, this sort of thing happened a lot. You'd have to, like, marry your rapist. It was horrific.
And so now she was Amelia Cianciulli.
Yay.
And from that time on, Amelia basically couldn't stand the sight of her daughter.
Sure.
Which, yeah, you can sympathize with. You can understand where that's coming from.
Also not good for the daughter.
Not good
to be
for,
around that.
Yeah, no, it created a brutal environment for little Leonarda, who said she didn't remember much about her father. He died when she was very young. But she did remember her mother spitting on her father's casket at the funeral and saying, "Good riddance."
Hmm. Okay.
Now, after her mother was widowed, it doesn't sound like Leonardo's life improved at all, but I think Amelia's life improved a lot.
Sure.
She went through several boyfriends after that while alternately ignoring and verbally abusing her daughter, who she basically hated, and told her how much she hated her, how annoying she was, how much easier life would be if she just wasn't around. Don't we wish they would all just go die? No.
Yeah, it's complicated. On the one hand, you can't blame her. She was sexually assaulted, had to marry her assaulter, and had to give birth to this child, which she might not have wanted to, but it's not like she had the choice. On the other hand, that's a really tragic situation for that child to be stuck in.
And so tragic, in fact, that by 14, Leonarda had reportedly attempted suicide twice.
Hmm.
She also said she became interested in superstition and in fortune tellers and fortune telling when she was young. And a fortune teller had once told her that she would be married someday, but that she would outlive all of her children. All of her children would die young. And this was a fear that just kind of gripped Leonarda for the rest of her life.
Wow, I'm relieved that my psychic reading wasn't that intense before I met you.
No, they didn't. It was just tall, dark, and handsome, right? Was coming into your tall, pale, and handsome.
They said that that we would have similar interests in our work, and we would meet within the next 6 months, to which I laughed in their face. And we would travel and collaborate on a certain project or projects together, like, maybe a podcast or something.
Great. Nothing about outliving your children or anything.
No,
like that.
No weird portents of dread.
No Cersei know. Lannister.
No, no. It was all on the up and up. But I did meet you within 6 months, so just throwing that out there.
Amelia, I don't know. It doesn't sound like she wanted the best for her daughter. It sounds like her daughter was more of a nuisance at best.
Mm-hmm.
But she started seeing her as a potential source of income. She started having little dollar signs in her eyes as Leonarda came of age, and it appeared that she shared her mother's good looks.
Oh.
Very beautiful girl.
Tell me she didn't pimp out her daughter.
Nope, nothing like that. At least not that we know of. But she was planning to arrange a marriage.
Okay.
For a hefty dowry payment.
Yeah. Well, she would be paying the dowry.
Oh, sorry, for a hefty payment the other way. I don't know. She was going to get her married to a rich guy.
Yeah.
They're both going to be taken care of, was her plan.
Well, I'm rewatching Bridgerton right now, and that's the usual state of affairs, Sean.
Well, it's also the plot of Titanic.
Yeah.
You know.
The best movie ever made, yeah.
Why did, that's the views of Caroline Ferrante McCabe do not reflect the views of Ain't It Scary.
My true thought, though it is one of my favorite films. But we've talked about that. Jack.
In 1917, a 20-year-old Leonarda was not going to be married off by her mother to anyone. And she instead ran off with an office clerk to avoid the marriage her mother wanted to arrange for her.
Like a romantic situation? To like elope with this guy or whatever?
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, Carrie, here's a picture of Leonarda Cianciulli in her youth. So this is probably maybe right around the time when the couple eloped.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a young picture of Raphael Pansardi, her beau here, the clerk who she ran off with. But here's a picture of the two of them much later in their marriage.
Italian Gothic.
He's really got it all going on.
They've got a lot of misery going on, it looks like.
He looks surprised that the photo was taken.
Yeah.
And she looks like she's never been surprised by anything in her entire life.
Mm-hmm.
And desperately wishes she would be.
Mm-hmm.
This was not a popular move with her mom.
Yeah.
And apparently she cursed the couple, or at least that's what Leonarda would write later. She said that this was when her mother placed a curse on them that they would be miserable for all of their lives. And Leonarda, at least, claimed to believe that she was still living under that curse all those years later as she was under trial for murder.
Mm-hmm.
In 1921, the couple moved to Raphael's hometown in Potenza, Italy, and they stayed there for 6 years. So, you know, they settled in.
Mm-hmm.
Leonarda got a job at a bank during this time. You know, working the straight and narrow. She tried to sneakily open a fraudulent account for herself and put a bunch of money in it, like just fake money, and go, look at all this money that I have. So she got arrested.
Oh.
After 6 years living in town and had to spend a little time in jail. And then the couple moved back to Avellino,
mm-hmm.
where they had started, although I think a different town. But the biggest struggle during this time wasn't, the time in jail. The biggest trouble was with having children. Leonarda would ultimately have 17 pregnancies in her marriage, but she lost 3 of the children to miscarriage, and then 10 more died in infancy.
God, it's like Queen Anne and The Favorite, and also in real life. She had 20 pregnancies, and they were just desperately trying to get an heir, and it never worked out.
Yeah, so I don't have anything about Leonarda, like, running around the house with a bunch of ducks and rabbits.
You know, but I mean, that's sort of, you know, one instance of something like that happening is traumatic for a person, just going through that over and over and over again. And you already have mommy issues and issues around your own conception, and then it's all mixed up in this horrific... I do feel bad for her.
Well, it did result in her being very precious about her son, Giuseppe, who was born probably around the time that the couple moved to Potenza in 1921, and also Giuseppe's younger siblings,
mm-hmm.
who I don't really know anything about because I don't think they were living with...
But there was only, like, what, 4 total surviving children?
4 survive past infancy, yeah.
Yeah, wow.
And so that can only have made those fears about her mother's curse, about the fortune teller when she was young, all of that stuff must have seemed fairly real to this rural woman in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
Or did it? I don't know. We'll discuss that at length later, Carrie, her ultimate motivations for the things she ends up doing. But that's after we tell you what those things are.
Okay.
Just as the family was settling in Avellino, you know, they've had a couple of kids finally, things are starting to look up, the 1930 Irpinia earthquake struck on July 23rd, 1930. It was a magnitude 6.9 quake that killed more than 1,000 people in central Italy, injured thousands more, and completely destroyed thousands of homes, including... the Pansardi Cianciulli home.
Mm-hmm.
And so the family had to move again. And this time they settled down in Correggio, Reggio Emilia, the name of the town that's in the name of this episode. And Correggio is now and was then a sleepy town nestled in the mountains of southern Italy.
Mm-hmm.
So Leonarda and Raphael and their kids settled down in Correggio, and she pretty quickly became a well-known, well-liked, and well-respected member of the community. She was known as a kind, gentle, generous woman. Pretty superstitious. Everybody noted she was a little weird, little superstitious, but it seemed like she'd had a hard life, so whatever. And certainly she was known as a doting, even overprotective, maybe, but either way, very loving mother to her 4 surviving children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Leonarda was obviously a pretty, dare I say, witchy person.
You do dare say.
And she found work as the village fortune teller and as a poetess, according to a 1946 Time article, Time magazine.
All right, dream job status.
In that Time article, it says, lovelorn women came up the canal path to her whitewashed door with a few coppers for the cards. And people would also, women especially, would come and just sit and visit and talk with her and sort of benefit from her motherly advice. She was like mother to the village kind of thing.
Cool.
Now, this other thing, it's not totally clear to me. She may have also run a shop. I think she did. In a few of the sources, but not in any of the newspaper articles that I found from the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
So the truth and veracity of this, I don't know. Here's the problem. This woman, Leonardo Cianciulli, is known as the soap maker of Correggio, and that's because, spoiler alert, she ends up making soap out of at least one of her victims. But it is not clear to me that she was a professional soap maker. That's not in
Maybe
all.
Maybe it was just a hobby, Sean. Well, I've made soap.
Well, that's the thing. In some of the sources, there's this elaborate, like, oh, and they had a shop front inside their home, and she had previously worked at a perfume factory, so she knew about different smells, and and she ordered a bunch of different oils and experimented to make the best soaps. Mm. And she was known for miles around for her soaps, but then other sources don't mention that at all and just say she was a fortune teller.
Listen, Sean. She had ADHD. She got a hobby. She had to get all of the oils and the gadgets.
What?
She would have gone crazy at a Michael's.
I'm just saying she might have run a shop. She almost certainly ran a little shop in addition to doing her fortune telling. She may have sold soap from the shop, but also people just made their own soap in this time. So yeah. when she says she has lye for making soap, I would assume it's just lye for making soap for her home. So
sure.
Anyway, I would need to see better documentation on the soap store. If anybody has it, then bring it to me. I just found that kind of unsupported in a couple articles.
Either way, she would have gone wild out of Joann's.
She would have loved a Joann's. She would have loved a Michael's. She's a crafty, witchy lady, Carrie. Are you loving it?
Well, I'm concerned because you keep on relating her to craftiness and witchiness and being Italian, but I know she's a murderer, so I'm just worried with what kind of accusations I'm going to be dealing today.
Well, she's not a murderer yet, Carrie, and she wouldn't be a murderer until 1939, when Leonardo's eldest son, Giuseppe, announced that he was planning on leaving home to join the army.
This is on the bad guy's side.
Oh, yeah. This is, yeah. Joining up with Daddy Mussolini's totally great, not doomed war effort for the Italian fascist nation.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, he's a patriotic youngster, and he's grown up in this, like, really grown up, because I think Mussolini comes to power in 22.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, this kid's whole life, he's had all this fascist nonsense.
Yeah, it's all he knows.
Anyway, he wants to go join the army, and I'm assuming there was conscription involved in the Italian army in World War II, but it seems like this kid was deciding to go join up. That's the way it's kind of painted in all the sources.
Maybe there wasn't a draft yet.
It's 1939. I mean, the war, they're in.
Yeah, it's going.
Either way, there was no talking him out of going, and Leonardo would later claim that it was, at this point, faced with losing another of her children, this time on the battlefield, she sort of snapped. And she
lost it.
She thought, I'll do anything to protect him.
Mm-hmm.
In her memoir, she would claim that she had been reading into more kind of occult philosophy. She had been reading about alchemy. And she had become obsessed with the idea that life must be paid for with life.
Listen, who hasn't read about alchemy, okay?
But it's never made you go like, okay, well, I probably should kill a couple of my neighbors.
No, I've never gone like, you know, one, son going to the draft, two, axe murder, three, four, profit off soap.
Well, actually, Carrie... You're way ahead of me, because there will be profit.
Okay.
But if she was going to make a sacrifice, first she would need a victim, or victims.
Okay, so she's really believing in the idea that she could maybe, like, get her son's life, you know, sort of taken care of, paid for, by sacrificing another.
Honestly, Carrie, it depends on who you ask.
Some people... think that she didn't actually believe this and it was just an excuse she came up with?
Yeah, we'll talk about it later, but it actually seems to me that English-speaking sources eat this up a little bit more readily, and in the Italian-speaking literature, there's a little bit more questioning of the face value of it all and of her story.
That makes sense.
But I don't want to interrupt the narrative here. I want to talk about that at the end.
Okay.
So, the obvious place, I mean, if you don't have a conscience or feelings, the obvious place to look for victims was among the often lonely, unattached women who came to her for help and advice.
Yeesh.
And the first was Faustina Setti. Faustina Setti was a 73-year-old spinster who had always dreamed of, but had never had, a great love and a husband.
Hmm.
She probably knew Leonarda through her fortune-telling, or had taken advantage of those services, even, you know, or had maybe come into the amazing soap shop down the road, for all we know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe she came in asking if there were any love matches in her future.
Poor Faustina.
In any case, sometime in 1939, Leonarda gave Setti some great news. A wealthy, retired friend of hers in Pola, Italy, had just sent her this letter. Produces letter.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the foley.
And the letter said that this older, wealthy friend just really wanted an affectionate older woman to spend his twilight years with, and did she know anybody nice?
Mm-hmm.
It's you know, you and I are on the lookout for email fraud and Nigerian prince schemes and stuff.
Sure.
I think we're a little more in tune to this. But also, Cianciulli knew how to pick a mark.
Well, and this woman probably trusted her.
She definitely trusted her, and she bought this immediately.
Oh.
Hard and fast. In fact, Faustina sold her home and all the rest of her property and dyed her gray hair blonde so she would impress her new beau.
Oh.
And one day in late 1939, she arrived at Leonarda Cianciulli's house with her life savings of 30,000 lira in cash, ready to depart for Pola.
This breaks my heart. She was probably so excited.
And so thankful to her friend Leonarda.
Yeah.
The two women sat down for a cup of coffee. And Leonarda suggested, like, hey, you're going to want to write your friends when you get to Pola, but you might forget, swept up in all the excitement. Why don't you write a few goodbye letters now?
Yeah.
And she produced a few postcards that she had ready for the occasion.
So helpful, Leonarda. Thank you.
As Faustina finished writing the last letter, Leonarda hit her in the back of the head with a hatchet. And I think...
Why'd she pick a hatchet?
I saw one that said she killed her in one blow to the head, but I think what the other account says that she also hit her in the shoulder. So I think she...
Pulled out and then went again?
Like, sort of flinched as she was bringing... She's never hit someone with a hatchet before.
Let's hope.
So I think she hit her in the shoulder and then reared back and came square down in the head the second time and killed her with the second blow. And that was the end of Faustina Setti.
That's so sad.
Yeah. It's incredibly tragic. And it sounds like her whole life was like not a barrel of laughs.
Yeah.
So to end this way is...
cruel.
It's cold.
Yeah.
According to Cianciulli's trial testimony and the unpublished memoir that she wrote from jail, she then dragged the body to a closet near the kitchen, stripped Setti naked, and used a saw and a knife to cut her into 9 pieces.
This is crazy to do, like, your first time out on the murder scene.
Draining the blood into a basin as she went.
I mean, maybe she's used to, like, doing this with animals and stuff. Maybe she's...
Rural Italian women, right? She's making soap. She's butchering cows.
I mean, butchering a person, ostensibly, I've never done it, but you'd think it would be a lot harder and
must
different.
Say, FBI, if you're listening.
Yes. Not all witchy Italians, hashtag.
Well, and a true Italian mother, Carrie. Nothing's going to go to waste in her kitchen.
Mm-hmm. And, okay.
And from Leonarda's official statement...
That feels racist.
I threw the pieces into a pot, added 7 kilos of caustic soda, which I had bought to make soap, and stirred the mixture until the pieces dissolved in a thick, dark mush that I poured into several buckets and emptied in a nearby septic tank. As for the blood in the basin, I waited until it had coagulated, dried it in the oven, ground it and mixed it with flour, sugar, chocolate, milk, and eggs, as well as a bit of margarine, kneading all the ingredients together. I made lots of crunchy tea cakes and served them to the ladies who came to visit, though Giuseppe and I also ate them.
So this is like a step, like if you've dried, if you've crunched up blood, you can just kind of throw it in the backyard. It's just blood powder. It's not going to do anything. You have to take an extra step to go like, I'm going to eat this.
Yeah. So
I'm going to make people eat this.
It's a little in the inexplicability of the eating of the, not only, you know,
I mean,
you
she just it. Went from 0 to 100 so fast. Usually serial killers, cannibal killers, they have to work up to this kind of stuff.
The cannibalism part is the only part that makes me go, maybe the human sacrifice angle. Maybe this is part of the human sacrifice thing.
Yeah, kind of like the Mercy Brown situation, the vampire panic where
they have to
grind up the heart for the brother to drink and eat so he's protected from tuberculosis or whatever.
Yeah, the brother potion.
You know, classic brother potion. You know, yeah, it might be a thing where like she had to participate in this, but like getting random other people to eat it seems just kind of like she was having fun.
That's just pranks and hijinks.
She's just yes-anding the whole situation.
She's a real George Clooney on set. She's a prankster.
Oh, yeah. You've been punked. You've been tea-caked.
Yeah, please don't tea-cake us, listeners.
Yeah, we've talked about a variety of disgusting tea-cakes, including the piss cake. The piss cake that the dogs ate in Salem. Mm-hmm. We got the heart cake, brother cake. I don't know if anyone, there's a lot of tea cakes involved in Rasputin's death. Just don't eat a tea cake from someone you don't trust.
Oh yeah. When he eats like 30 tea cakes and there's
I fucking love these tea cakes.
He's like, there's enough drugs in there to kill a bull moose.
Yeah. And he's just housing them. Me with Girl Scout cookies, to be honest.
We'll do Rasputin someday.
That's going to be a 1,000 parter and it's going to be great. But yeah, I mean, official ain't it scary position, don't eat a tea cake that you haven't seen being made.
You should make it yourself.
Yes.
Tea cakes are suspect, always.
Yes.
We'll put it on a t-shirt. I don't believe Leonardo Cianciulli ever mentions that 30,000 lira, by the way. But records do suggest that this woman had about 30,000 lira on her in cash when she went to her
house. Not letting anything go to waste, Sean.
She had liquidated about 30, you know, grand in assets, and then she vanished, and that money disappeared. No word on that. Wink, wink. But a few days after Faustina disappeared, Leonardo's son, Giuseppe Pensardi, traveled to Pola on apparently unrelated business.
Mm-hmm.
And just while he was there, his mother asked if he could mail a few letters for her.
Oh, so it would have, like, the Pola stamp on it? That's so messed up. She really put some thought into this.
This is a
deviant behavior.
This is a deeply premeditated murder. And, I mean, spoilers, I guess. She's going to do 2 more of them before she's caught. We will cover those poor ladies, what happened to them, and what ultimately happens to Leonardo Cianciulli after the break. But first, Carrie, what do you think?
I think I just want to get it out there. I want to make it known. Hashtag not all witchy Italians.
She runs this campaign this time every year.
Science, science, science. Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes! Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.
Welcome back. When last we left you, I had introduced you to Leonardo Cianciulli. There's no other way to say it, Carrie. A witchy Italian Libra. A witchy Italian Aries.
Listen.
She's out here crafting.
Okay, we all like a Michaels.
I bet she loved true crime.
She loved committing it, that's for sure.
Yeah, as we found out just before the break, and as we'll continue to find out here. She was sort of the local fortune teller, right, Carrie? And we just saw her lure one of her clients and friends into her home, convincing all of her own, you know, relatives and friends in the area she was leaving town. And she disappeared her.
I can't believe we've dealt with a Faust and a Faustina this axe murder march.
I wouldn't have it any other way. I mean, we were talking about a lot of Satanists last week, so that was, yeah. You know, that was particular.
Mm-hmm.
But Faustina was a new one on me, yeah. The second victim to fall prey to Leonardo's web of lies was 55-year-old Francesca Suavi.
How old is Leonardo at this point?
She's like that photo you saw.
So I can't tell. Like, you know.
Sure, people just
1939 aged like, old. She might have been like 42 in that picture.
People aged like milk. Let's see. This is arithmetic. She's 46 years old.
Holy shit. So I really wasn't far off.
No.
She looks old in that picture.
And her husband. I mean, her husband looks...
like. They look okay.
And
I was joking with 42 because I thought she would be at least 60.
I have reason to believe they're separated, by the way. I read that in at least a couple of sources, and he doesn't appear in any other than those references. He doesn't appear like during this time period in any account of this story, and neither do their other children. So I think Raphael and the three other kids are just elsewhere.
Probably for the best.
Probably. Because there's a lot going on at the Cianciulli house.
Making soap, making blood cakes.
So Francesca Suavi was a widowed school teacher who lived alone not far away from the Cianciulli house. And Leonardo told her during a visit one day that she had found a very cushy job at a school for girls in Piacenza. And would she, you know... would she like to go? Would she like to take this high-paying job at a very nice school in a nice town?
See, there's a difference between like being some sort of zealot thinking that you're pulling off a sacrifice to save your son, and then there's like really, really crafting these stories to really fuck with these women and get them right in her grasp.
She was a master of like identifying a person's deepest desire. And then gaining their trust, like actually convincing them that, because these are suspicious offers.
Yes.
And we shouldn't picture this as an instantaneous con, right? We shouldn't picture that she's not working to convince at least Suavi that this is legit. Because it wasn't until September 1940 that Francesca was ready to take the plunge and make this huge upgrade to her life. And so, like Faustina, that's almost a year of cajoling and convincing and, oh, here's some more details on the school. And just like Faustina Setti before her, Suavi visited before she left with the friend she just owed so much to, this whole new chapter in her life. Two more postcards were written to friends in town, this time to be mailed from Piacenza. It is... wild. The wildest aspect of this story to me, Carrie, is that she convinced these women to write these letters.
Multiple times. I mean, but that's also so premeditated, so...
cruel?
Like, you know you're doing something wrong. If you think that you're creating this sacrifice to save yours, if you're really believing that, you're probably not viewing what you're doing as wrong, but she's covering up her tracks in so many different ways that she knows what she's doing is wrong.
She definitely does. There's all the, yeah, there's no legal defense here for insanity or I didn't know what I was doing or any of that stuff. She would spend time in a mental hospital later.
Yeah, that's also for the best.
After the postcards were written, Cianciulli, I guess she had given Suave a glass of wine to drink while she wrote the postcards. And as the drugs and the wine kicked in and she started getting sleepy, Cianciulli hit her in the head with an axe.
I'm so curious about the axe. It's just such an aggressive weapon to choose.
Well, she claimed to abhor violence.
Okay, well, I don't believe that.
So, I mean, maybe
you could have just poisoned these people then.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's like you already poisoned her. Why go the extra step? But, you know, strangling someone would be less bloody, but it would take a lot longer and more effort.
Well, there's a reason why many women kill by poison. It's quiet. It doesn't get your hands dirty. And so it seems like she's really
getting into it.
She wants it.
Little Carla Faye Tucker.
Mm.
The Sydney Morning Herald reported that Cianciulli wrote, "While my victim was drinking an elixir I had prepared, I got an axe, placed myself behind my victim, and, summoning my strength, struck the back of her neck. A rattle, nothing else. It was a master stroke that almost beheaded her."
Yeah, she's enjoying herself. You're not calling stuff a master stroke if you're not really wanting to be doing this.
I deeply regret this master stroke.
You know, if you're thinking you're doing a sacrifice and you feel bad about what you're doing, you're not like, yeah, and my axing was great.
Francesca was disposed of in much the same way Faustina Setti had been. Although Leonardo probably only made about 2,000 to 3,000 lira off of this one. She didn't have nearly as much money.
Boo-hoo.
The third victim came much faster on that one's heels. Virginia Cacioppo, 53 years old, was a former opera singer. A bit of an opera star, actually. She had sung at La Scala. And she really missed her high glamour past and was yearning for a reason to return to city life. And so it was very exciting for her that in her conversations with her friend Leonardo, she found out that Leonardo thought she could arrange a job for her as the secretary for a rich arts patron in Florence. Well, the perfect job, right? Like this couldn't be more tailor-made opportunity for me. The only catch, Leonardo urged Cacioppo not to mention her, Cianciulli's involvement.
This is like Survivor, okay? We've been watching Survivor, and it's like they try to pull the same trick on someone that they just pulled last week to get someone out. And it's like, no, I know what you're doing.
I did this with you last week.
Yeah, we did this yesterday.
But Virginia wasn't in on the past schemes.
Yeah.
But
it's just, it seems, yeah.
So she urged her not to mention her, Cianciulli's name, because she said that she was pulling strings to get this job through a guy she was having an affair with. She didn't want
to
screw
up. So she's creating tea to go along with this. She's storylines here. She's enjoying herself.
She's like, you'll screw up my divorce with my husband. Don't tell on me. I'm doing you this favor. Now, Virginia would take the job, and it didn't take as long to con her as it did the last victim, because on November 30th, 1940, Virginia Cacioppo met her end. But she did break Leonardo's rule. She was so excited about this opportunity, you see, that she had to tell just a couple of friends and relatives about her new job, and that would end up being Leonardo Cianciulli's undoing.
Good.
So November 30th, 1940, Leonardo murdered Virginia Cacioppo with a hatchet.
Mm-hmm.
She later wrote, "She ended up in the pot like the other two. Her flesh was fat and white. When it had melted, I added a bottle of cologne, and after a long time on the boil, I was able to make some most acceptable creamy soap. I gave bars to neighbors and acquaintances. The cakes, too, were better. That woman was really sweet."
God. She's messed up.
Sick.
She's got some problems, I don't mean to go out on a limb here, but she's got some problems.
You know, Jeffrey Dahmer doesn't didn't, he's dead, rest in peace. He didn't talk casually like this about his crimes, you know what I mean? I mean, there's that dead, emotionless voice thing, but there wasn't this, like...
cavalierness?
Yeah, like it was just going to the store.
Yeah.
It's interesting. It's chilling.
It is.
Once again, pocketing everything the victim owned, Leonardo reportedly ended up with over 50,000 lira this time.
And what's she doing with this money?
In cash and bonds. She's spending it.
Okay.
Along with jewels and jewelry.
That must be suspicious.
Yeah, and she was starting to get sloppy here. She established a pattern at this point, but she obviously, like you said, had a pretty locked down plan right from the start.
Mm-hmm.
But several of those bonds she had just stolen were registered and would end up being traced back to the deceased Cacioppo. And Cianciulli also started, I guess, giving away some of Cacioppo's jewelry as gifts to friends.
And this is like a small town.
And so when this stuff ended up in shops and stuff, that also started getting traced back.
Sure.
But none of that would matter, ultimately. I mean, it was helpful evidence, but the thing that really blew this case open was that Cacioppo's sister-in-law, Albertina Fanti, was getting suspicious. She had last seen Virginia entering Cianciulli's home, and at least an hour and 40 minutes later, she knew she hadn't left the house.
And everything smells real weird.
Well, you say that. She knocked on the door to talk to both women.
Oh, it must have been horrific.
And only found Cianciulli there, who said, "Oh, Virginia left a while ago. You must have missed her." And she said that Cianciulli was stirring a foul-smelling pot on the stove.
Yeah.
Fanti would eventually go to the local police superintendent, and a long investigation would finally corner Cianciulli on all three crimes. Remember, there was the bonds and the jewelry. There were all these loose ends they had to tie up. They discovered these other murders along the way and figured out the details. She was eventually arrested but wouldn't confess to any of the crimes until suspicion began to fall on Giuseppe as an accomplice.
Mm-hmm.
How, police wondered, could this little lady have done these murders and these dismemberments by herself?
Was he not in the military actively at this point? I mean, I know he was going to a different town at one point, but...
This is confusing to me as well. He was definitely around for the first murder.
Mm-hmm.
I think he may have been out of town by the time the other ones took place, but then I don't know how he could have been considered as an accomplice, because...
Maybe she's just doing that in preparation for him going out and joining the army.
Maybe he's not joining the army till 1940, but I mean, we're in late 1940 by the time this last murder takes place, so it is interesting.
What are you waiting for, Giuseppe?
Immediately, once suspicion started falling on Giuseppe, Cianciulli spilled the beans, explaining exactly how she had done it, and why she had done it, and why she didn't need help doing it either.
So, in survivor terms, her only alliance is to Giuseppe.
Yes, he's her number one. Mm-hmm. She's taking him to the end.
Mm-hmm.
A 1952 article from the Australian paper Truth, so you know it's true, says police actually challenged Leonardo's ability to have done the dissections so quickly. In the case of one of the murders, it was like, well, for Giuseppe not to have known about this, you had to have dismembered this body in 12 minutes. It's not possible.
Right.
Or like 15 minutes or something. At which point she, quote, accompanied police, judges, and doctors to the Reggio Emilia morgue and expertly dissected a corpse into 9 pieces in the astonishing time of 12 minutes.
Take that.
She loves it. This is her event. You can't hold her down.
She's doing, like, the triathlon of murder.
Yeah. she is, and she's winning the gold. Leonardo Cianciulli was finally tried for the murders of Faustina Setti, Francesca Suavi, and Virginia Cacioppo in 1946. In jail, awaiting trial, she wrote a 700-page memoir.
It's really a cookbook, but...
Well, it does have recipes in it. I mean,
yikes.
I read a recipe, technically, earlier in this story. It is entitled Confessions of a Bitter Soul. Not to be confused with Chicken Soup for the...
And not to be confused with Confessions of a Dangerous Mind, which they also were.
Yes, technically accurate. And that memoir is the source for much of the information that's out there on this case and her life, so we have to take all of it, basically, with a grain of salt, except that these women ended up dead.
Mm-hmm.
And unrepentant to the last, Leonardo would confess again in court, even calmly correcting the prosecutors and court officials on the precise details of the crime. From Time Magazine, "At her trial in Reggio Emilia last week, poetess Leonardo gripped the witness stand rail with oddly delicate hands and calmly set the prosecutor right on certain details. Her deep-set dark eyes gleamed with wild inner pride as she concluded, 'I gave the copper ladle, which I used to skim the fat off the kettles, to my country, which was so badly in need of metal during the last days of the war.'"
Thanks.
Cianciulli was found guilty and sentenced to 33 years in prison, which I guess was basically as high as the legal code went.
Mm-hmm.
And she died of cerebral apoplexy in the women's criminal asylum in Pozzuoli on October 15th, 1970.
Wow, she lasted a while.
She certainly did, in a number of prisons and asylums. And you can see, Carrie, a number of artifacts from this case, including the pot that she boiled these women in, at the Criminological Museum in Rome.
And we missed it?
And so
I didn't know there was a Criminological Museum.
An obvious stop for our next trip, Carrie. You can't get that copper ladle there, of course, because that, I guess, became bullets and buttons for Uncle Mussolini.
Great.
Now let's talk about motive and truth. I mentioned we can't take anything as gospel fact in this story except for the three deaths.
Mm-hmm.
Because it all comes from Leonardo. She claimed that she committed these murders in the belief that sacrificing these women's lives would save her son while he was in the army. And her son did serve in the army at some point, but it's very hard to get precise details. But he obviously wasn't deployed when she committed the first murder because he was, like, around and delivering letters for her and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There's a 2008 documentary. It's only available in Italian, and I can't find a single place that you can watch it. Called The Soapmaker, Life of Leonardo Cianciulli. And apparently, that documentary argues that Giuseppe was complicit in the murders and probably actively assisting in them, and that most of what Leonardo said, re-human sacrifice and stuff, was just a successful campaign to throw suspicion off of him.
Now, why?
Why was he participating? Why do the murders?
Why do the murders? Why participate just for the money? Was he benefiting from what she was doing?
I think the 82,000 lira is the motivation.
Right. Well, you said that she was, you know, spending and stuff. I didn't know if he was getting any of those benefits.
Oh, that's a great question. The only reason I think Giuseppe might have been involved is because otherwise he's just a real dummy. Like, the idea that she sent him up to the city to mail some letters back to their hometown.
It's a little weird.
It's very suspicious.
I'd ask about it.
I would ask, why? And she's like, oh, the postage rates are better there. Really?
Okay, but I still have to travel.
About the gas?
Yeah.
So, you know, either he wasn't great at economics or he was complicit in these murders. I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's possible that all the coverage of this case over the years is a victim of not only sensationalism, but I mean, I guess sensationalism is a word for it. But because she was a superstitious lady, I think it's easy for people to paint with a broad brush and go like, oh, human sacrifice. Sure, she was a weird fortune-telling lady. That makes
sense.
Well,
witchy ladies making blood cakes. Everyone loves that. Look at Sweeney Todd.
Well, exactly. But so that fits into a predefined narrative of our own preconceived notions,
mm-hmm,
about why such a person might commit such a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a story that keeps her son safe, which... whether or not human sacrifice was involved, definitely one of her motivations was this son that she was obsessed with.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I come down. I think she murdered these women in cold blood to steal their money, which is wild. And then I think in getting him, whether he helped or not, in getting him all of the way out of the frame and maybe kind of ennobling her own motives, she made up all this bullshit about human sacrifice. I'm not aware of any... Like, I've never seen anyone cite the rituals she was doing
or the
religion they came from.
I guess I see, with the human sacrifice angle, I see where she loses it, right, is him saying, I'm going to go to war, and her freaking out like, I'm going to lose another kid, and thus losing her mind. But if she's not doing it for those reasons, then I don't really know what set her off to go from this sort of mother of the town that everyone likes and trusts to, oh, I'm going to commit a fleet of murders.
Well, if she was separated from her husband at this point, which I believe, again, his name does not come up in like in the trial.
Well, she did say that he ate the cakes, right? Or was it Giuseppe?
No, Giuseppe.
Oh, Jesus, she makes him eat the cakes. Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, it could just be monetary. I don't know. It just seems like there might be a missing piece there.
Do you think there's an extra murder? I mean, her method is so developed on the first
one. I mean, she really went from 0 to 100. I wouldn't be surprised. Maybe she started with trying to poison someone. They only got sick. And so she's like, well, I really got to do the 1-2 punch with the hatchet. I could see that happening.
On Faustina Setti, or you mean,
or
another murder?
Or someone else, maybe. It could be on Faustina. But yeah, maybe she tried a test run and it didn't take, so she had to get more aggressive with it. Yeah, but I don't know. I think we're missing a piece of the real motivation. If it's not a life for a life, so to speak, what set her off and made her actually decide, okay, I'm going to just completely reverse how I've been my whole life and in this town and switch gears. Obviously, she's committed financial fraud and stuff before, but it seems like she's been settled into this place and into her role in this town for quite a long while.
For years before the murders started. Yeah, and people liked her.
So if it's not something that was precluded by Giuseppe saying, okay, I'm going to go join the war, then I feel like there must be a missing piece in there somewhere.
Very interesting. Well, maybe we'll return to the story if we ever get any more clarity on it.
Oh, yeah.
Otherwise, for now, that is the tale of Leonardo Cianciulli, the soap maker of Correggio.
Not all soap makers, people.
Hashtag not all soap makers.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Warriors in Their Own Words, a podcast that presents the unvarnished, unsanitized truth of what we have asked of those who defend this nation. As a country, we need these stories more than ever. Stories from Americans who have borne the battle, including 30-year-old remastered interviews with veterans from World War I recounting their time in the trenches of Europe, and with veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, and from our most recent conflicts in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other battlefields Americans may never have heard of. Hear their stories by listening to Warriors in Their Own Words wherever you find podcasts.
It's Lizard People Big World for hopefully the last time on this topic. As you are likely aware, unless you live under a blissfully news-free rock, and in that case, you got room under there for one more, Kate, the Princess of Wales, emerged this past week to settle everyone's debate on where dat princess, and unfortunately, the answer was fairly grim. The princess took to a video produced by the BBC to tell the public that she did indeed go in for her stomach surgery, but cancer was found during the operation, and she has since been receiving treatment for the unspecified cancer. The delay in revealing the truth to the public, in her explanation, was so that this mother of three could have time to discuss the matter with her children before it hit the press. And thus we see why we here on Ain't It Scary don't usually cover serious non-crime breaking stories, because, well, you run the risk of getting it very wrong and saying something shitty when you shouldn't. But I do stand by our covering it in general, because I don't know the last time that I've seen conspiracy discourse so prevalent in the media outside of our currently messy world of QAnon and partisan politics. And it definitely would have been weird to not even mention it, given our considerable track record discussing the real stories behind the royal family. I also stand by a lot of my feelings on the matter. It does seem that it was indeed a case where Kate could not physically be seen or be brought into public until she was well enough, which corresponds to my theory that she either couldn't or wouldn't do a sort of proof of life press event to put all the theorizing to bed. Obviously, she couldn't. But it's also remarkable just how badly Kensington Palace bungled the whole situation. Like, how is it better that instead of seeing your mother's health news in the press, the kids ostensibly would have seen instead rampant speculation in actual mainstream media that she was divorcing their father because of an affair, or that she had been murdered, quote, just like Princess Diana? The palace just exercised zero crowd control on this one. And then throwing Kate under the bus for the whole Photoshop fiasco and forcing her to issue a mea culpa on Twitter about it, when you know it was probably just some staffer that cobbled together the picture to try and shut people up.
I mean, no, that it was.
Yes. So, I mean, talk about insult to injury, you know? Now, yes, everyone deserves the chance to talk to their children about difficult private matters, no matter how much of a public life they've signed up for, but there should probably be a better strategy to calm the frenzy than the shit show they pulled the last couple months. And I'm not saying Kate in this they, I'm saying Kensington Palace, the whole structure of...
The institution.
The institution as a whole. You don't have to be specific or even say cancer, but phrasing things differently and leaning into the seriousness of the situation would have kept the public at bay a lot better than trying to pretend everything's hunky-dory, even though we haven't seen this woman in months. It was obvious that something was being withheld, and people don't like feeling like they're being lied to or tricked. That's just the bottom line. No matter how much of a right they actually have to be privy to the information in question, they don't want to be lied to or feel like they're being punked. They also caused another problem by trying to obfuscate the public with this whole situation. The conspiracy theories have not actually gone away in light of Kate's video. Perhaps it's because it was just such an interesting conspiracy to debate in the first place. One TikTok creator who discussed the various theories told Wired, quote, "The topic is an ideal mainstream conspiracy theory. It's low stakes, easy to obsess over, and endlessly iterative."
Like Stevie Wonder not being blind.
Exactly. "There's no easier build-your-own-adventure story than the one that can be built around a woman who is simultaneously famous and unknown. She's a perfect lightning rod for this kind of obsession, like Diana was, and still is, for example." In the continuing theories, many have argued that the video is clear AI, and have noted that Kate still hasn't been verifiably seen in person, and not in a grainy video clip or a highly produced BBC video. There are also other strange details coming out, like that Prince William wasn't present at Kate's video filming. So do you not think your wife might want your support as she tells the world she has cancer? It seems weird that he wasn't there. Or the fact that a helicopter was photographed, I think might have been today or yesterday, leaving the palace for Easter, but for some reason Kate and William were not photographed actually entering the helicopter and proving that they were in it. It was just like, see this helicopter? Yeah, Kate's in there. They're going to Easter. It's just very strange. It's like, well, why didn't you show her getting in? You know,
it's just more bad handling.
Yeah, it's just it seems like you more like you're lying to people. Even if you aren't, you're acting like you are. And people don't like that. Of course, there are other conspiracies, like that Kate got her illness from receiving the 2021 COVID vaccine.
Okay.
I know. It's an example of the insidious ways this sort of thought can twist and bend to try and warp others' opinions in a certain way about things that aren't even related. Speaking of insidious, experts have stated that the bulk of fuel on the conspiratorial fire in regards to Kate Middleton originated in Russia, China, and Iran, leading some in the UK government to be concerned that this disinformation was pushed to try and destabilize the nation, according to The Telegraph.
That, I don't know.
That's what these experts supposedly told The Telegraph.
I mean, I think a lot of misinformation originates in China and Russia.
No, yeah.
Anyway.
But it's just another example.
Yeah.
For our part on this show, I think it's similar to how Stephen Colbert discussed it after making affair jokes regarding Kate's disappearance on The Late Show. We're not here to make light of anyone's tragedy, no matter if we know the truth about it or not at the time of the discussion. It's like a major tenet of our show, and so we apologize if any of the discourse, which at its base was intended to be informational, seemed flippant now that we have more details. But discussing the conspiracies in a journalistic way was and still is relevant to Ain't It Scary, and this was a pretty fascinating microcosm of how conspiracy thought multiplies and spreads through word of mouth, social media, and the press, and how hard it is to stop it. I don't think we'll soon be fully past murmurings of conspiracy in this situation, nor the ramifications of how this whole story was handled from the inside out for quite a while. We also want to extend sincere, because we know she's a listener, of course.
Big fan.
We want to extend sincere get well wishes to the princess, because no one deserves to be going through this, and certainly not on the public stage, no matter how prepared you are for the public stage. We hope that she can deal with the rest of this situation peacefully, and that those that are supposedly looking out for her best interests when it comes to handling the media get their shit together for her sake. And that's kind of where we're at now. If there are any developments, we'll let you know, but that's kind of where we're at now.
Well, if we can't respectfully discuss these sensitive issues on a segment called Little Lizard People Big World.
Well, you know.
Where can we?
Puns are needed, okay?
Puns heal the world.
I'll never apologize for a pun. That's it for this episode of Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Ain't It Scary, and check out our website at ain'titscary.com. You can support the show by supporting our sponsors and becoming a patron at www.patreon.com/ain'titscary. You can call us and leave a message at our Google Voice number, 203-666-5529. And please subscribe to the show and throw us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts and also Spotify. We'll be forever grateful.
We certainly will. And special thanks to those of you already joining us on Patreon: Sean O'Donnell, Jared Chamberlain, Maria Ferrante, Robin McCabe, Comfy Mike, Alex Nakutis, Ryan Regan, Christy Atchison, Kate Pope, Haley, Ryan, Enrique, Ira, Pete, Anna, Delaney, and Sue. Tune in later this week on Patreon for a little more bonus axe murder content.
Ooh. See you next Thursday.
Show created by Sean and Carrie McCabe. Music by Kyle Ryan. You can find Kyle at his YouTube channel, Music is a Verb.
Ain't It Scary has been brought to you by Killer Podcasts and is a production of Longboy Media.
Coming up on 5-Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not. It's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5-Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.